Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Last week, the Dayton Daily News reported that both of Lieutenant Governor Mary Taylor's adult sons are opioid addicts. Taylor says they're doing well, although one of her sons remains in treatment. But treatment is not a universal given for addicts. Taylor, a Republican running for governor in 2018, opposes the expansion of Medicaid, which the current governor says is necessary given the opioid crisis in Ohio. Going without treatment can be deadly. Since 2007, 21,000 Ohioans have died of accidental drug overdoses. But treatment is expensive, and there's a shortage of beds. This week, news broke that Mary Haven is planning to open a 50-bed facility with room to expand. It's the latest response to the high demand from people addicted to heroin and other opioids. We're talking about the cost of treating opioid addiction today. Joining me is the manager of medically assisted services at Mary Haven, Andrew Moss. Welcome to the show.
Good morning.
Also, CEO of the Alcohol, Drug, and Mental Health Board of Franklin County, David Royer. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Why is treatment so expensive?
I think there's I guess it really reflects as part of healthcare in general and the costs associated with healthcare. I think the other part of it is that the price of some of the medication assisted treatment agents that we're using are incredibly expensive. Let me just give you an example. There's one, Vivitrol. It's an agnostic.
No. Agonist.
Antagonist. Sorry about that. But it's $1,000. Per injection per month. So, you know, when we look at that, that gives you an idea of some of the costs associated. The other thing, too, is that when someone's in treatment, that there are a lot of costs associated with medical clearances, the necessary, the blood work, the room and board, the professional staffing. So I think all of that lends to the cost of treatment.
Andrew Moss, you're adding 50 beds. They will be separate from the treatment center's 32-bed main campus. Why is that? Just because of logistics, or is there another reason?
Well, that's a plan that's still in development, so there's not much I can comment on regarding that. But we do know that opiate addiction is widespread throughout the community, and we are always looking for ways to expand into the community to meet people where they're at.
Well, now Rita Price reported on the 50-bed expansion last week for the Columbus Dispatch. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand that it was still in development. Mm-hmm. When are you expecting to open it?
Well, that, again, is still something that we have not decided or determined exactly how that will work. But that should be something we can comment on, hopefully within the next couple of months.
Yeah.
Yeah. So as part of the process when we were developing the opiate action plan for Franklin County and the city of Columbus. Mm-hmm. We went around as part of the ADAMH. We were charged by the mayor and by the county commissioners to go out and try to begin to have a conversation with our community. Essentially, one of the biggest things we heard, especially from EMS and emergency room physicians, mm-hmm. was that there was the lack of somewhere to take someone who had overdosed.
Right.
And I'm sure you've heard that before.
Yeah.
And it was the number one source, I think, of frustration that we consistently heard. And so the ADAM board, working with Mary Haven, we've begun to develop this plan. We're hopeful that by September we can become operational. Perhaps our plan is to hopefully bring the financing package to our board of trustees in July. I can tell you, and this goes back to your previous question, the costs associated with operating this kind of a center that is essentially a stabilization center for overdose victims as a way of trying to engage them in the treatment and hopefully transfer them to his expertise of medication-assisted treatment. Right now, we're looking at the total cost for something like this is about $7 million to operate per year. So it's a very, very large project, and it'll probably be one of the largest projects we've done at the county level in the last 10 to 15 years.
But it's reflective of the immense demand.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yes. You know, I think we know that through EMS and naloxone administrations, we can easily have say 9 to 15 overdoses per day. And so if we could even engage half of those folks in believing that there's a better opportunity by having a facility that can receive them when they're motivated, and that's one of the key things that we heard was this frustration about you got to capture them when they're motivated.
And it's usually when they've hit rock bottom, they've mm-hmm. overdosed.
Exactly. And I can tell you, last year we expanded our detox center at Alum Creek. We added 8 beds
to the 32
existing facility.
Okay.
And it's had a huge impact on the number of people that we've been able to treat so far. Last year at this time, I think we had admitted about 500 people to detox, which is pretty substantial. This year, to date, about 925 people.
There have been other changes besides the expansion of mm-hmm. beds, though. There's been the reduction in the time they spend, all things being equal. Mm-hmm. It varies, but you told the dispatch that some people aren't staying as long as they might have in the mm-hmm. past. So what's the difference?
Well, the demand, I think, is growing.
So it's by necessity.
Yes.
But what about the effectiveness, then, of the treatment if they're not staying there as long as they would have?
Absolutely. I think what we're trying to do from the front end is really examine what a person's unique situation is. Some people, for example, may be well-suited for MAT initially. We may medically assisted treatment.
Okay.
We may streamline then to that level of care rather than taking through the traditional detox and inpatient residential. I think trying to come up with individualized plans from an earlier point in time has helped us be more effective with our resources.
How much is the counseling? How much does that play into it? Is it just about taking another drug to deter you from taking the bad drug, or how much do people need a lot of counseling?
On a personal level, I really believe that it's imperative that someone have a more deeper understanding of how they got to where they're at. The medication-assisted treatment can support that person with issues about craving. But at the end of the day, until there's an embracing of understanding how you got there and how you work your way through it and begin the process of recovery. That's why it's so critical that we just simply don't believe that treatment starts with medication, where we're converting them from one agent to another agent, mm-hmm. so to speak. That's why and that really supports the recovery process.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. And we see that in comparison with some of the organizations who provide MAT but don't offer the counseling element. Something Mary Haven, I think, does very well is their structured treatment, counseling, group and individual that goes along with the medication. I completely agree.
There isn't a comprehensive treatment resources list on the county website, and you've said that the website feels fragmented. Can you talk about what your concerns are, David Royer?
Sure. I think in some ways that whole issue reflects the fragmentation of healthcare in general and the changing nature of how healthcare is delivered. But there are a variety of both publicly supported and private nonprofit and for-profit providers of care. And so I think to really tackle this at a community level, there's a couple things we need to do. One is there has to be a resource that any person at any time can go and say, wow, these are the options that are available to a community. And I think when the Opiate Action Plan is presented to the community, we're going to have that as a strategy. I think the other thing, too, is that within the treatment community, and the action plan actually calls for this, is the development of, if you will, an electronic board that will allow us to better understand where capacity is available. One of the other problems that happens is that when somebody is motivated, we can't get into where, well, maybe you can call this provider or that provider. What we have to do is, I think, use technology creatively to understand who has capacity, because, again, it's that moment in time opportunity that can't be lost.
Are you expecting the county to be sort of at the fulcrum of that?
At the end of the day, I think so. Yeah, I think I I think that some of the development of the technology will come out of our office at the Atom Board. Where it's located and how it's managed, I think, still is up for discussion.
A couple of weeks ago, Breaking Point Recovery Center told, again, Rita Price at the Dispatch, that they had a new 16-bed treatment center in Whitehall, but they had made multiple attempts to reach out to Adam H. and to be included on the county site, and they weren't. What's the deal with that? Has that changed?
No, it hasn't changed. And just to give some historical perspective on that is that anytime the board does not have a contract with every alcohol drug treatment center in the county. We have, I think, 33 different nonprofits we contract for publicly supported services. Our policy has been to have those that we do business with, if you will, on our website. Mm-hmm. This is an independent organization that we don't have a contract with. I think, though, that that point that
what difference does it make if you have a contract with them or not?
Well, I think it's just been historical preference. I mean, by the board, I think what's very clear is that we have to look at this in a more strategic way, and that's what we intend to do.
Okay. And I wanted to talk about insurance coverage because I heard an NPR story the other day about a town in Florida. I think it's Delray, Florida or something. Mm-hmm. It's sort of turned into a rehab hub. But there's a lot of monkey shines going on, too, with insurance companies unwittingly paying for care that's not up to snuff. Mm-hmm. You must see that out there in the industry. What about it, Andrew Moss?
Well, I think that we primarily work with clients who have Ohio Medicaid. And so we're bound to a standard of practice based on that. And we also work with a lot of clients who are funded primarily by the Adam H. Board. I think the nature of addiction for the people that we see at Mary Haven is that they're at that bottom that you had mentioned. And they tend to lose their resources pretty quickly in the throes mm-hmm. of addiction. And so we really rely on the support of Adam H.
What about the Medicaid expansion? Mm-hmm. Are you aware of the extent to which that's affected the number of people that can seek treatment?
I think it has increased it greatly. Again, though, with the nature of addiction, people won't always recertify their
right.
insurance and won't
right.
always present for meetings.
So then you have to get them covered
for.
And all that stuff.
Yes. Yes. It's huh. it's a process.
It's been a critical thing. It's been so beneficial to mm-hmm. Ohio, to Ohio citizens. One of the things that gets lost sometimes in that discussion, at least from the behavioral health side, is that it also allows us to engage that person in their physical health care. Mm-hmm. As you can imagine, when you're going through the throes of an addiction, you let your physical care obviously deteriorate. And just by the nature of the addiction, your body's going to deteriorate. And so the Medicaid expansion not only allows for that behavioral health intervention, but it also allows for that physical health intervention, which is critical to moving them on to a healthier and more stable well-being. Mm-hmm.
Let's go back to the medication-assisted treatment issue. It's been controversial. Critics argue that treating opioid addiction with more medication isn't the answer. You mentioned that earlier. So what is the – and it's also extremely expensive, as you mentioned. Medicaid pays for that?
Medicaid does pay for that in many situations, yes.
This is kind of new, isn't it, mm-hmm. this medication-assisted? I mean, we've heard about methadone. You know, the methadone, that's what most people are familiar with, mm-hmm. Clinics for heroin addiction. What's the difference between methadone and these other, like Vivitrol and that kind of a thing?
Just in the ways that they affect the body and the brain.
Okay.
There are some physiological differences. There are some medical conditions that would prevent a person from trying one medication versus the other.
But the effect they have on the body, hepatitis C, man, if they have hepatitis, they mm-hmm. can't take methadone or Vivitrol?
Well, that's going to be up to a physician's evaluation.
Okay.
And that's where that lab work comes in that David had mentioned.
But the chemical effect, the thing that they're trying to achieve with mm-hmm. the medication, is it the same with methadone and Vivitrol? Or are they just brand names or what?
The medication in some cases will block the effects of withdrawal.
Okay.
And in some cases will block the effects of if somebody tries to use on top of that medication, they will not feel that euphoric feeling. And in some cases, medication can help with the cravings as well. Vivitrol does not necessarily help with cravings as the others may. But I think it depends on the individuals again. ability to take
the idea
meds.
Of blocking the effects of withdrawal. Some people say, why do you want to do that? Why not make it as painful and horrible as possible so that they don't want to go through it again?
Well, historically, people, when we did that, before we had these medications, the success rate of a detox for opiates was very, very low.
They couldn't complete the detox.
They couldn't get through that point. And what we're seeing is these medications are saving lives, but I don't think they're standalones. They need to be accompanied by structured treatment.
You know, and I think when if someone was to witness – literally witness what would it look like and feel like if it was their family member, they would not want them to detoxify without medication supports. It's a very ugly thing to experience. And I say that from conversations with recovering addicts that said, if I, you know, I never want to go through being dope sick again. And so it's a very traumatic.
Meaning they won't go through withdrawal again.
Yeah, they would never want to experience that again in their life. You know, back to the methadone, I think sometimes that what's has been lost in the current conversation is that here in Franklin County, through Comp Drug, we've been treating heroin addiction for the last 40 years.
Right.
This is not the scope and magnitude, and I've been in this business for a very long time, the scope and magnitude of the problem has never – I have never seen anything like this. That said, we know that the issues of heroin, especially as it has affected the African-American community over the years, has been significant. Mm-hmm. And so I think we benefit. Excuse me. I think we benefit from the growing awareness about the issue. I think what we have to stay cognizant of is that it affects all aspects of the community, regardless of race, gender, economic,
absolutely,
wealth.
That's been an issue. Mm-hmm. People say, "Why now?"
And I also think that when we talk about cost, there is a cost associated with not treating these conditions. I think it's vital that we invest money and resources because you think about the economic cost of continued drug use and drug-related crime. You think about the rates of incarceration and the costs associated with that.
Child neglect?
Absolutely. I mean, this has an impact on the entire system. Whether we're investing in treatment or not, we know that when we invest in treatment, there's more hope for long-term recovery.
They want to add quite a bit of money to the state budget for the crisis. What would you use more funding for?
I think there's a couple core areas, four core areas that we have to look at. One is risk reduction, the healthcare aspects of the addiction process. I think community education and prevention is a very important thing. And that community education it really permeates across the spectrum from very personal experiences that families go through, such as online support structures, recovery apps for early stage recovery, community awareness education, obviously treatment access. One of the largest criticisms that we heard when we did this plan was that there was not timeliness to access to treatment. And so one of the things we're looking at is how would you incentivize same-day access with the treatment community?
Incentivize who?
The provider.
Oh, the provider.
The provider to have more immediate real-time service availability.
Yeah, someone was talking about – I was reading about that even weekends, intake on weekends, and I thought, well – you mean that there hasn't been intake on weekends before? That's a thing?
Mm-hmm. In the past, there were staffing issues. There was a shortage of staff, and so we had to limit when we could bring people in. And I think we've really been much more aggressive about that in the last year.
Because of that opportunity lost.
Absolutely.
Well, this is an ongoing conversation. I don't know if we'll ever finish it. But Andrew Moss, thanks for joining us today to talk about it.
Thanks so much.
Andrew Moss, Manager of Medically Assisted Services at Mary Haven. Also, David Royer, CEO of the Alcohol, Drug, and Mental Health Board of Franklin County. Thanks to you as well.
Thanks.
More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Whether it's a minor sprain or a freak accident, most athletes will get hurt at some point in their career. There are physical limitations to our bodies, even for professionals. Dr. David Geyer is the author of a new book that chronicles the history of sport injury, how it's led to rule changes, the adoption of protective gear, or in some cases, the elimination of the sport altogether. Dr. Geyer is an orthopedic surgeon and sports medicine specialist in South Carolina. His new book is entitled That's Gotta Hurt, The Injuries That Changed Sports Forever. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You start your book with Joan Benoit, the first female Olympic marathon champion. She took off from the starting line just 70 days after undergoing knee surgery, and that's pretty incredible. What was her injury, and how was this even possible?
Yeah, she was training for the Olympic trials and started developing pain in her knee that just was keeping her from training. We didn't have MRIs back in those days. So basically, they were trying anti-inflammatories and shots into her knee, and she wasn't getting better. So her surgeon proposed basically unheard of thing where he would stick a scope in her knee through a couple little poke holes, look around, try to find the problem. And that's what he did. And he found what's called a plica, a little inflamed band of tissue that actually bothers a lot of runners. He clipped it, and she was able to get back to basically, like I said, train, not just train, but compete and win the marathon trial 17 days after surgery. And it really put arthroscopic surgery on the map, and now that's done hundreds of thousands of times in the year in the U.S. every year. But people really didn't know about it until that happened.
You know, I hear a lot about arthroscopic surgery, but and anyone who's awake these days has heard about it. But it's not the go-to that it once was. It sort of peaked, didn't it?
Well, it really depends on what the surgery is trying to achieve. So the what she had, where a doctor just goes in and looks around, that's really gone away. MRI has really made that unnecessary.
Okay.
Because now we know what we're looking for. But there's a lot that we can do arthroscopically now that we couldn't do back in the 70s and 80s.
Like what?
Well, like ACL surgeries and these rotator cuff repairs and tears of the labrum, the cartilage bumper in the shoulder. We used to have to make big, long incisions across the body to get down into the joint. Now we can do it through a few poke holes.
So if a marathon runner felt that same sharp knee pain that Benoit did in her training run, how would it differ today? There wouldn't be the big, long scar for one thing, right?
No, there definitely wouldn't be. The first thing is we'd get an MRI. We'd hopefully find the cause of the problem and know what we were getting into.
Okay.
And if the MRI was negative, he or she might not need surgery at all. But then, yeah, it would be an arthroscopic surgery if the person did need surgery. And then, the rehab and all that. It still makes what Joan Benoit did amazing. The idea of running a marathon 17 days after surgery would be just as crazy today and unlikely as it was back in the 1980s.
Which makes her the champion. Most of us are not. But I wonder if those kind of things, when they happen, when you see people head back to a sport like she did, how that creates unrealistic expectations among everyday athletes.
I think that there's a good point to be made, and I think that, not just Joan Benoit, but really whatever we watch in the professional level sports, we want to be able to exercise, those of us that like to exercise and play rec league sports, but we have to listen to our bodies and give ourselves enough time to recover. These athletes are being paid millions of dollars sometimes to play, and there's a lot of pressure on them sometimes to return too soon. But when we're looking at our long-term health, we've got to make sure our health is such that we can play with our kids when we're older. We can, basically run or lift weights when we're in our 50s and 60s. And injuries, if we don't take them seriously, can certainly, really decrease our ability to do that later in life.
And if we don't take them seriously, it does affect a sport's ability to change its rules to reflect our growing body of knowledge, right?
Yeah, no question. I mean, I think that that's one of the things, as we're being able to diagnose more injuries, we've got to do a better job. It's great that we can treat injuries, but we have to be able to prevent them. And if there's simple rules changes that we can take that eliminates an injury, we at least have to entertain that idea of changing a sport in small ways to keep kids and athletes out of the operating room.
You wrote about New York Knicks basketball star Bernard King and also soccer star U.S. soccer star Brandi Chastain, both of whom suffered ACL tears. King back in 1985 and Chastain, of course, much more recently. But are there gender differences? I mean, does it matter if you're female or male when it comes to something like an ACL tear?
Absolutely. And this may surprise people that don't play sports, but female athletes and active females are somewhere between twice as likely and eight times as likely to tear their ACLs as male athletes. Thought to be related to how women land from jumps and how they turn, but they do it in positions that are much riskier. The good news is, as scary as that sounds, we can largely prevent ACL tears, or at least a huge number of them, probably somewhere between 40 and 70%, with some exercise programs that you do as basically your warm-ups before practice every day. And I think that that's something, if you're a mom listening to this and you have daughters that play sports, you should ask your coaches and ask the athletic trainers on those teams about these programs, because if that can save you a surgery and a year out of sports, we absolutely need to be doing that.
That sort of always drove me bonkers watching my own kid grow up in sports. I never felt like they did adequate warm-up and cool-downs after sports. I do more after my stupid boot camp than I saw him do after pretty rigorous workouts in hockey and track, field, cross-country, that kind of a thing.
I think there's something to that. I don't want to throw all coaches under the bus, but I do think there is this thought among a lot of coaches. You know, they only have a certain amount of time each day and each week with the team and with the kids, and there a lot of coaches are very reluctant to use any of that time for things other than training in that sport, you know, running plays and doing the techniques. And they feel like these kids can warm up and cool down and do stuff after practice. But as you and I know, you know, a lot of kids, unless the whole team's doing it and the coach is pushing them to do it,
yeah,
they're just not going to do it.
Right. So we got more kids playing in sports today than ever. You write that 1 million children played high school football, 2.5 million between 6 and 14 play tackle football. You know, when you got that many people, young people out there in a sport, in any sport, that we're not keeping up with our growing body of knowledge about flexibility and warming up.
Yeah, I think you're right. And with these growing participation numbers, I think that's a sign that we need to get the education out even more. And it's really tough in the U.S., unlike Canada and some of the European countries, where there's sort of a governing body that oversees all sports. It, you know, in the U.S. is sort of fragmented by sport. Soccer, the certification is within the soccer community, and football and cheerleading and all these are sort of fragmented by their sport, and it really makes getting that information about athlete development and flexibility and muscle strength really difficult, because you got to get it out to, you know, in each different sport. And I think that's something that we need to look for, because at the end of the day, you know, these kids, largely the injuries are preventable, but, you know, we've got to take the steps, we've got to do the education to make sure that those, that we do prevent those injuries.
John in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air with Dr. David Geyer, author of That's Gotta Hurt, The Injuries That Changed Sports Forever. Hi, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're addressing what my question was, or my comment, just in the last few comments about the adequate training of the school people and their knowledge about working with the kids and staying strong and flexible and stable. But I guess maybe I'll add another dimension to the conversation. I sometimes question the intensity of the training and the sport, and, you know, the need to reach that absolute level of excellence. And if maybe we're not harming ourselves by the young people and the coaches really, really pushing the limit to intensity just for success. Do you have any comment about that?
At a younger age, Dr. David Geyer?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think the data, if you look at the science, there's some sports that probably do benefit from that early specialization. Gymnastics and figure skating are the two that really come to mind. But for the vast majority of the sports, these kids' bodies aren't ready for that kind of intense training. They don't have the muscle strength that the training the 10,000 hours puts on their joints. And so that's why half of all youth sports injuries are overuse injuries. And this mentality of pushing kids to specialize in one sport and pushing them to win and focus on statistics, I think has long-term issues, not just with injuries, but burnout from sports. I think it's largely why 70% of kids stop playing sports by age 13. And that's something we absolutely need to fix.
What determines when an athlete is ready to return to play?
Boy, I tell you, that's a complicated
$6 million
answer.
Question, right?
Yeah, I mean, so part of it is the injury physically healing, the whatever the injured structure is actually healing. And that seems like it's straightforward, but how you know when that's happened is even tricky. At the pro level, we can repeat MRIs every week and do all these fancy tests. But even then, it's hard to know, is that repair strong enough to then withstand going back to play? And the risk you run, you know, at the pro level all the way down to us as weekend warriors, is if you go back and that injury hasn't fully healed, then you re-injure it and you start all over, and you may set yourself up for chronic injuries. So some of it is going to the doctor, getting tested, doing physical therapy, I think is really important, and then basing, you know, try it out, slowly work back into jogging or lifting weights, see how your body feels, and then very slowly push yourself back into that sport.
But are they doing that at the professional level?
Yes and no. I think that it's largely been a challenge, and that's been one of the concerns of the pro athletes. Our doctors and the teams rushing players back too fast? And it's hard because they need them to play, and the fans want them to play, and the athletes want to rush back to play. So it's really tricky. It's probably not done as well at the pro level as it is done at the youth level and for all of us as adults.
And another thing, when it comes to things like concussions, how much can you trust, I mean, unless you can see something in an MRI, how much do you trust the reportage of a child when it comes to injury?
No question, it's challenging, because if doctors and athletic trainers don't see a kid get hit and see them wobbly on the field, we're not going to know to check it. And so, you know, we see the pro players, you know, Tom Brady apparently recently and Calvin Johnson, there's been this talk that they played and hid the concussions from the medical staff.
Right.
That gets down to the youth level. And these kids, you know, one, hide them so they can play, and two, don't know the risks. And so I think that's absolutely crucial that parents and coaches and doctors talk to these kids and say, hey, look, you've got to let us know that you're having headaches or blurry vision so we can check you out, because we know the dangers of repeated blows to the head if a kid hasn't recovered fully from a concussion.
There's another interesting aspect to all of this, I think, and I don't know if you wrote about it in your book or not, but the equipment issue, how equipment that protects us can also encourage rougher play.
Yeah, there's no question. And that's one of the arguments with the football helmet.
Yeah.
They're getting better and better. The technology's better, but it probably does present a false sense of security to these players. They just go into tackles fearless, and no helmet can prevent a concussion. Yes, they're better than nothing, but they're designed to prevent skull fractures. They don't prevent the brain from rattling around inside the skull.
The closed head injury.
Yeah, and so that's the challenge. I would never argue that we shouldn't explore better helmets, but that alone is not going to make a huge difference in protecting kids from concussion. So as parents, it's just one piece of a bigger puzzle.
So that's where the rule changes come in, right?
Yeah, and I think that's what we're looking at. You know, maybe we've moved kickoffs. You know, we've eliminated targeting where you can hit players above the shoulder pads. But I think we're going to have to get into more aggressive rule changes. I think the repetitive blows that occur on every play, what the experts really think leads to the long-term brain damage, that we're going to have to look at. So do we go at, you know, maybe eliminating tackle football for kids and just make it flag football or passing league football until they're 14 and then they switch to tackle football? I think something like that is probably coming over the next decade.
You wrote about the death of professional cricket player Philip Hughes of South Australia. It's not a familiar sport in the United States, but can you talk about him and how cricket rules and safety changed because of that?
Yeah, so he was, and it leads into people that have kids that play baseball. You know, Philip Hughes was a prominent cricket player. They were bowling, which is essentially like pitching in baseball, and the ball bounced and hit him in the sort of the back and the side of the neck, right below the helmet. it ruptured his vertebral artery, which delivers blood to the brain, and he died. That was wearing a cricket helmet. And then that gets to the discussion of, can any protective device prevent every injury? It's very similar to baseball pitchers. We see a couple of these injuries every year where the batter hits the ball, you know, line drive right at the pitcher, and they get a skull fracture or a fracture of the eye socket. Very, very serious injuries. Should they be wearing helmets and helmets with facial protection? And what about the catchers getting hit in the chest that get a condition where it basically stops the heart, commotio cordis? Equipment is definitely good, and we need to explore making it better. But, you know, at what point can we prevent all of these injuries? And at what point can we mandate that certain players have to wear certain types of equipment? Very, very tricky discussions.
What rules changed in cricket, I guess, as best you can describe it for the uninitiated?
Yeah, so what they did is basically, and it's still being debated, quite honestly, is they eliminated or how often you could use what they call fast bowls. It's the speed that basically it's like pitching in baseball, but in cricket you can actually throw essentially a ball that goes at their head to sort of drive them back to intimidate them, mm-hmm. and they've limited how often you can throw those. You can still do it, but you can't do it every pitch, things like that. But that's a great example. Cricket's one where people argue that because of the helmets, these batsmen are fearless now, and they don't get out of the way. And Philip Hughes probably should have gotten out of the way. He'd probably still be alive today. So is the helmet technology actually causing more problems? It's really a tough dilemma that they've got.
One last question. We know there was a movie made about the physician who finally isolated the long-term injuries associated with repeated concussions in football players. Is the medical, you know, are the physicians who treat teams in this way, are they part of the problem or what?
I don't know that they're necessarily part of the problem. I think we're all trying to do what we can for the long-term health of the players. I think that football generally was sort of slow to recognize this problem, and they were, you know, a lot, not just the doctors, but a lot of people involved with football. It sounds like we're really trying to protect the sport. And I think that that's something that there's more awareness of. But in defense of, like, all team doctors, this is something that there's a lot of moving parts, and we need a lot more research. But the focus has to be on both from the pro level to all of us that play sports. We've got to do what we can to keep people healthy so that they can stay active later in life. That's true for us. That's true for pro football players.
Dr. David Guyer, thanks for your time today. Appreciate it.
I really appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Dr. David Guyer, an orthopedic surgeon and author of a new book entitled That's Gotta Hurt, The Injuries That Changed Sports Forever. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Almost everyone has a cell phone, which means almost everyone is exposed to trace amounts of radio frequency waves or radiation. Still, with every new study that emerges, the debate over whether cell phones cause brain cancer continues. We're talking about that and other health news today. Joining us by phone is chair of the editorial board of the University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter, Dr. John Swartzberg. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Why can't public health people get an answer about the cell phone issue when it comes to brain tumors?
It's a really complicated thing to study, as you can imagine. It's been a moving target in terms of the types of cell phones we've had since the 1990s. They've changed a great deal. So people are using them much more, and the amount of radio frequency radiation that comes from them has dramatically changed. So that's been a moving target. And then how do you really study how often people are using a phone and over what period of time? Because if the radiation that comes from these phones is causing a problem, it probably would take decades. So it's a real difficult area to get a solid answer in.
Why would it take decades?
Well, the radiation that's coming from these phones, it's not what we call ionizing radiation, which is known to cause damage to DNA and therefore can cause the generation of tumors. This is a different type of radiation that, at least in the past, has not been shown to cause any problems like tumors. So that's the first piece there. The second piece is that even with ionizing radiation, to lead to the development of tumors usually takes decades. It doesn't happen just overnight. It takes repeated challenges to the cells, and slowly over time, those cells change and form tumors. So this is a long-term process, not a short one.
So, and really, cell phones haven't been around that long.
Well, they've been around now, what we're going on, 3 decades or so. So we're just about at the time when we can look at the effects of this over enough time. But again, coming back to what I was saying about the fact that the amount of cell phone usage has dramatically changed, mm-hmm. increased, and the amount of radiation coming from these has actually decreased to some extent. So it's, again, moving targets.
Has there been an uptick in the number of brain tumors that are suspected to be related?
It depends where you look. Overall, the answer is we've been seeing an increase in the number of brain tumors since the 1950s. So the increase appears to have occurred at least about 30, maybe even 40 years before the development or wide use of cell phones. So that clearly there's something that may be causing an increase in brain tumors, but to implicate solely cell phones would not be appropriate because it was occurring for a good while before that. And that's data from the United States and some other countries, but there have been some countries where, for example, in Scandinavia, where we haven't seen an increase in brain tumors. So again, that's very confusing.
Last year, the city of Berkeley passed a right-to-know law requiring retailers that sell cell phones to notify consumers about the potential radiation risk. How has the cell phone industry responded to that?
Well, they weren't real happy about that.
I guess not.
Yeah, San Francisco actually passed an ordinance before, and that was challenged in courts, and San Francisco removed the ordinance. The Berkeley ordinance is being challenged, but to date it stands. It's a right-to-know law that people should know that there is some controversy about this topic.
So how are they? I mean, are they putting up signs? Are they doing...
Right. If you purchase a cell phone in the city of Berkeley, there's a sign there, and it states essentially that you're being notified that there is the potential for radiation to cause changes that could potentially lead to tumors. Lots of coulds and mays. Mm-hmm. But consumers are being warned about that. You know, this falls into this really difficult area, what public health people call the precautionary principle. That is, if there's the possibility of a problem, then we ought to really warn people about that, at least let them know. But, you know, that's a slippery slope. And where do we stop warning people about the problem? Where does public health become paternalistic? And that's what people are really arguing about right now.
You recently wrote about advanced glycation end products, or AGEs. What are they, and why should we care?
I'll tell you in just one second, but I want to say one other thing about the cell phones first. And that is, I want your listeners to understand that it's been very difficult to demonstrate that cell phones cause tumors. There's been some evidence that that can happen. But if they do, it must be very, very rare. If this was a really serious and common problem, most experts think that the data would have shown this a while back. So I wouldn't really panic about this issue.
Okay.
Okay. So advanced glycation end products. This is what results from our body's normal metabolism of foods we eat and perhaps foods we even consume. And these end products are, we have mechanisms to get rid of them, but they accumulate over the years. And there's some evidence that the accumulation of these over the years, particularly as we get much older, may contribute to damage to blood vessels and chronic inflammation and perhaps even premature aging. Lots of maize there also, mm-hmm. But it's an intriguing area for exploration.
What's the bottom line? Should
right
the bottom line existence is, of AGEs change how or what we eat?
Right. The bottom line is, if you follow the diets that are recommended by the Centers for Disease Control, FDA, USDA, et cetera, you're in good shape in terms of doing everything we know to prevent the accumulation of these products. So, for example, eating more fish and less meat, particularly red meat, because red meat, particularly the way we cook it, tends to cause a lot of these AGEs. As a side on that, marinating meat can decrease the amount of AGEs that are formed when we cook them. Eating a diet that's more with a lot more fruits and vegetables tends to decrease the amount of AGEs we form, as opposed to a lot of fried foods like, for example, fried potatoes and chips and so on. So it really comes down to avoid the junk food, avoid the prepared foods, and cook them yourselves, and eat lots of fruits and vegetables, decrease the amount of meat you consume, follow diets like the Mediterranean diet or the DASH diet that's recommended by the CDC. Those are the things we know that you can do to avoid accumulating these products.
Let's turn to sleep.
Okay.
We've talked about it before. Never can't talk about it too much, in my opinion. The National Sleep Foundation recently published four key indicators to determine good quality sleep. And one of them is falling asleep within 30 minutes of going to bed. Do you know what the magic is there?
What they did was they looked at over close to 300 studies to try to understand what was good quality sleep. And they came out, that was one of the parameters they came up with, that people who slept, who took longer than 30 minutes, these were people under 65, who took longer than 30 minutes to get to sleep, they tended not to have good quality sleep. That was one of the four parameters. Another one was that you need to be sleeping at least 85% of the time spent in bed, and waking up no more than once per night for longer than 5 minutes. So those were essentially the major criteria that we found. If you're over 65, we gave you up to 60 minutes to get to sleep. Because people's sleep patterns change as we age. So bottom line to this is, if you're concerned about the quality of your sleep, you know, we talk a lot about quantity, but we don't talk about quality, and that may be equally important. One of the parameters would be, how long does it take you to get to sleep? And if you're under 65 and it's taking more than 30 minutes, I think that's worth having a discussion with your physician or perhaps even a sleep specialist.
Now, here's one that I couldn't really suss out very well, and I don't know if I'm just rushing my brain through it, but being awake for less than a total of 20 minutes after initially falling asleep.
Yeah, that's a tough one. What that means is that you may wake up several times during the night, but go right back to sleep. So the total of those times is not going to come to 20 minutes, and that's fine. It's the people who wake up in the middle of the night and then can't get back to sleep for 10 or 15 minutes. And if you do that twice, you're over the 20-minute limit. And that's an indicator that you may have poor quality sleep.
And what do we know about the typical reasons why we're not getting a good night's sleep?
That is a real difficult issue. Sleep has been one of the areas in medicine that has not been adequately studied over the last several decades. We're doing it a lot more now, but it's really one of the last areas of human activities that have not come under rigorous scientific study. So to be continued on that one.
Okay. Dr. John Swartzberg, thank you so much for joining us today as usual. I always appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Dr. John Swartzberg, chair of the editorial board of the UC Berkeley School of Public Health Wellness Letter. Thanks for listening. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.